Our next speaker is Yana Lambrindu. She is adjunct assistant professor in science and technology studies at Virginia Tech. Dr. Lambrindu has conducted extensive research on Washington, D.C.'s historic 2001 to 2004 lead in water contamination. This work exposed wrongdoing on the part of local and federal government agencies. The public health and public policy research that she'll discuss today was funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the D.C. Water and Sewer Authority.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming to this session. Hi, Lizzie. Good to see you. Today, I'll be talking about the federal lead and copper rule, which is undergoing revisions as we speak, and lessons that we can learn from homeowner personal experiences with this law. I have nothing to disclose, except for, like Steve, extreme frustration. What would you think about a public health policy that gave you partial responsibility for protecting yourself and your family from an environmental hazard and recommended that you take a specific protective action which required a significant amount of your own money, but did not ensure that you had necessary technical information to understand fully the benefits of this action, and your failure to take the action had the potential to cause serious health harm, especially to fetuses, infants, and young children in your home? Welcome to the Lead and Copper Rule of 1991. In a nutshell, this is the lead pipe replacement program that's a requirement of the Lead and Copper Rule, which was promulgated to protect the public from lead in drinking water. Lead pipes were condemned for the serious health harm that they can cause over 2,000 years ago. Vitruvius in ancient Rome stated very clearly that water ought by no means to be conducted in lead pipes if we want to have it wholesome. But the United States did not listen and installed an estimated 10 million lead pipes across the country, with the highest concentrations in the Northeast and the Midwest. In 1986, EPA stated that every year over 250,000 children are exposed to lead in drinking water at levels high enough to impair their intellectual and physical development. Lead pipes were banned in 1986, and in 1991, EPA stated that as little as 5% to more than 50% of children's total lead exposure can come from water. But when it comes to infants dependent on formula, they may receive more than 85% of their lead from drinking water. Now, the Lead and Copper Rule made it clear that no level of lead in water is safe for human consumption, but mandated remedial action only when the so-called lead action level of 15 parts per billion was exceeded. Now, under the Lead and Copper Rule, remedial action is required only when over 10% of taps in a small number of targeted homes tests over 15 parts per billion for lead. And then the mandated remedial measures are source water treatment if source water is contaminated, corrosion control optimization, public health education, and lead service line replacement, which is the focus of our study. Now, what makes the Lead and Copper Rule really unique and different from other drinking water regulations is that the source of the targeted contaminant, lead, can actually be private. So lead can leach from plumbing that belongs to homeowners. Because of this particularity, the Lead and Copper Rule deems consumers at least partly responsible for lead at the tap. And so this is how this affects the lead pipe replacement program. It is very common for one part of the lead pipe to belong to be owned by the water utility, and the other part to be owned by the homeowner, with the homeowner with the property line being the demarcation, the separation line. Under the lead and copper rule, when a utility exceeds the lead action level, it is required to replace its part of the line only. It is required to offer homeowners that they pay and have their side replaced. If a homeowner agrees to pay, then you have a full, complete lead service line replacement, which is the optimal solution. But when the homeowner is not willing to pay, water utilities are still required by law to go in and replace only their portion of the side of the pipe. The problem with this is that partial pipe replacement has raised serious health concerns for decades. EPA knew about these concerns before promulgating the lead and copper rule. In the final rule, the agency said very clearly that there's potential risks associated with partial pipe replacements, and also mentioned warnings from public commenters who said that replacing only part of the line actually risked resulting in lead spikes after the replacement that would place consumers in higher risk rather than lower. Indeed, studies have found that in partially replaced lead lines, lead spikes can occur from two processes. One is the physical disturbance of the pipe that can release lead rust and lead shavings, which can fall into the water. And then two types of corrosion, galvanic and deposition corrosion, which can occur when old lead is paired up with new copper. A battery effect can be created, and then lead starts to leach at an accelerated rate. In the 1991 rule, EPA argued that these concerns, although valid, did not justify delays in implementation of the program because, and EPA gave several reasons. The first is EPA predicted that the vast majority of homeowners would actually pay for private side replacement and that partial replacements would just be an oddity. That really did not pan out. As it turned out, most homeowners have opted out of full replacement. In Washington, D.C. and Providence, Rhode Island, two cities with the most extensive lead pipe replacement programs in the country, only 18% and 1% of homeowners have actually paid for private side replacement. On a national scale, what this looks like is that partial replacements have taken place in at least 13 states and the District of Columbia and are estimated to far exceed 38,000. The second and third reasons EPA presented in defense of its program are that replacing any length of lead pipe will make water safer, and spikes in lead, if they occur at all, will be temporary and will decrease over time. Well, neither of these predictions turned out to be true either. By 2005, the water industry had reached general consensus that partial replacement did not reduce water lead levels and might actually substantially increase them. A 2011 study by the CDC found that children in Washington, D.C. homes with a partial replacement were twice as likely than children in homes with an intact lead service line to have elevated blood lead levels. And the same children in homes with a partial replacement were four times as likely to have elevated blood lead levels as compared to children in a house with no lead service line at all. The CDC controlled for confounding factors and found this association to be true even when the utility met the lead action level. That same year, EPA's Science Advisory Board reviewed the literature on partial replacements and concluded that partials have not been shown to reliably reduce drinking water lead levels in the short term, ranging from days to months and potentially even longer. And a study that was just published by EPA Region 5 in Chicago found that when a lead line is disturbed, which happens invariably during partial replacement, high lead levels can be found in tap water for years afterwards. So the next reason that EPA presented in support of the program was that short-term exposure to lead immediately after replacement is preferable to long-term exposure. And CDC and the EPA's reason really was based on the assumption that lead levels would drop off over time. Okay, again, the EPA got it wrong. Studies have shown that lead spiking can actually occur long after the time of partial replacement. On the left, you see the inside of the lead pipe, a lead pipe right at the point of contact with copper, and the dramatic accumulation of lead after 1 year of this contact. This is not atypical. Lead levels in particles from a junction like this can actually far exceed, in terms of lead content, the Consumer Product Safety Commission's acute health threat for lead. EPA's last defense was that utilities would actually inform residents about the potential risk of partial replacements, so residents would be able to take necessary precautions if they had a partial replacement. So we started off wanting to find out from homeowners if this final point was true, but we also quickly broadened our study to explore the lead pipe replacement requirement as a whole from homeowners' perspectives. Why do homeowners opt out of full pipe replacement? Do they not know that it's in their interest to replace their pipe fully? Do they understand that it's in their interest? Is cost the only obstacle to replacement? So these were the kinds of questions we looked at. We conducted 39 semi-structured interviews of four groups of homeowners with a partial replacement or a full replacement in Washington, D.C. or in Providence, Rhode Island. And we looked at homeowner experiences with lead pipe replacement with a replacement's shared responsibility regime. We looked at why most homeowners do not go for a full replacement, and if utility recommendations about precautions after partial replacement are actually followed. We conducted an inductive analysis to identify codes and emerging themes. What was interesting to see right away is that homeowner reaction to the pipe replacement program consisted of acceptance and even enthusiasm by almost half of the people we interviewed. But interestingly, 72% of these individuals happened to be in the highest income bracket, reporting an annual income of over $100,000. The rest of our interviewees expressed outright disapproval and even anger with the program, discomfort, but resignation, or an overall sense of disengagement. Common themes in the acceptance group were perceived affordability. This was low cost to some people, very affordable, health protection, resale value of the home, desire to replace old infrastructure. One homeowner said, in the case of our house, it needed to be replaced. I never considered this program optional because it's a public safety thing. In the rejection group, common themes were perceived high cost of the replacement, injustice of having to pay extra for full protection, disapproval of the fact that the utility's responsibility stopped at the property line, and inadequate information. One homeowner said, you know, the utility's information informed me about what they were going to do, but it didn't help me make any informed decisions. Another homeowner said, you know, that was the option. Either get unsafe water, or you pay and you get safe water. Well, that's not a choice. Another homeowner, it's like me telling the power utility that the power line feeding the house is down and then saying, oh no, it's not our responsibility. We're only responsible for the wires outside on the main pole in the yard. Made no sense. And another homeowner, she wanted to figure out if there was a way to have the utility to postpone these replacements so that she could organize her community and somehow figure out to raise funds for full replacement. The resignation group really came up with similar themes, but homeowners here expressed more discomfort and confusion rather than outright criticism of the program. Again, the cost was still prohibitive, somebody said. It ended up being another source of irritation. I wasn't too thrilled that they were not replacing the full line. You know, the utility people were perhaps protecting themselves, and they would cut their replacement responsibility as short as wherever they could say it was my responsibility. Is it better to have partial replacement? I suppose. But would I rather have full replacement? Yeah. And the disengagement group communicated a general trust that whatever the utility was doing out there was probably fine, and they didn't even consider full replacement. Some people in this group didn't even know that there was a lead action level exceedance in their city. Highlights are that the lead service pipe program's shared responsibility regime, as it exists today, is agreeable to many homeowners with some means, is disagreeable to many homeowners who cannot afford private side replacement, is inadequately educational in relation to the public health purpose of the intervention, the nature and health risks of lead in water, homeowner versus utility rights and responsibilities, the benefits of full replacement, and the risks of partial replacement. Also, the program seems to be inadequately collaborative or supportive to individual homeowners who want to assess what risks specifically they face in their house, what remedial measures are best for them, and how to afford costly solutions like full replacement. Really, the number one cost that homeowners gave for opting out of full replacement was cost. Recalled estimates for full replacement were $1,000 to $7,000. What's noteworthy is that 80% of homeowners who had a partial replacement said that if private side replacement were paid by the utility, they would absolutely go for it. So here we see the clear rise of private side replacement with income, and also a clear connection, racial differences between homes with a full and a partial replacement. 56% of white Caucasian homeowners were able to choose a full replacement, 30% of black African American homeowners were able to choose full, and only 25% of Hispanic Latino. And utility recommendations for precautions, were they followed? If precautions were taken, and in many cases homeowners said they took no precautions at all, they involved a one-time flush to just clean out the pipes immediately after the replacement, which clearly is completely inadequate for a partial pipe replacement. So there go. It's a pretty. There we go with a pretty depressing picture of EPA's lists of justification. From a public health perspective, there really seems to be no justification for this program that has gone on now for quite a number of years, since 1991. But possibly the biggest takeaway message is that 50% of homeowners who ended up with a partial replacement said that if the short and long-term health effects of a partial replacement were actually spelled out clearly to them, they were far more likely to go with a full replacement and figure out how to do it. Conclusion is that the majority of homeowners do understand that a full replacement is in their interest, that's true, but cost, inadequate disclosure of the latest science on replacements, inadequate education, and inadequate support to individual consumers leads to a lot of partial pipe replacements, inadequate water use precautions, and very serious questions about environmental justice. In the end, the question we're faced with is if this shared responsibility idea behind the partial pipe the pipe replacement program is really more of an abdicated responsibility on the part of both regulators and the water industry. Policy implications. I will close with good news and bad news. The good news is that, as I mentioned earlier, the lead and copper rule is being revised as we speak, and it could be changed, if we're optimistic, to mandate full lead service line replacement, and also to mandate a new notification requirement that truly informs and supports homeowners. The bad news? A survey that came out in 2011, this is the year that the CDC study was published, and the EPA Science Advisory Board raised concerns about partial replacements. So that year, a survey came out that showed that water utilities may have found a way to actually gift lead service lines completely to consumers. Up until 2007, 79% of utilities reported owning a portion of lead service lines in their jurisdictions. All of a sudden, somehow, miraculously, in 2011, almost the same percentage, 69% of utilities, claimed that they own no portion of a lead service line in their jurisdictions at all. This means that even if the lead and copper rule lead pipe replacement program, were revised in favor of public health, that we may still not see much progress. In closing, I'd like to thank all the homeowners who gave us their time, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, DC Water, Miguel Del Toro and Mike Schock from EPA, who have been extremely helpful, and our colleague Ralph Scott. Thank you.